gentlemen, welcome to minute 135 of season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we fubar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today in order to finish off this week are both Christian Taylor and Corey Johnson. Welcome back, guys.
Pleasure to be here. Much.
Yeah, we missed you the last few days, Corey, but we'll get back to you on that. We'll let you do the extra top five, you know, for the World War II, and we'll let you play the game also. You know,
I don't think my World War II top five is going to be like anyone else's.
That's perfect. I'm looking for unique stuff. So there you go.
Yeah.
That works perfect. Yep. All right, excellent. So minute 135 begins with Henderson shouting an order and ends with Mellish giving up on a message. So basically we finished things yesterday with the guys starting to get ready for this fight. They're waiting for all these Germans to come by, and everything is chaotic. Amazing camera work here. Takes us, one of the things I've mentioned this many times about this movie is that you constantly feel that you are right there with these guys. And it's just amazing. Yeah. And the shots here tell us that, show us that. We're there.
Yep. One thing I think Spielberg does, not only in this movie, but it became a hallmark of his style, because it's not about a camera work, even though it's reflected in camera work. It's about storytelling. And he was an absolute genius at storytelling. I've been lucky enough to work with him, and I've worked with Ridley Scott, and on stage I've worked with Sam Mendes, who is in their league, because what they do is they manage to tell. It's a two-dimensional thing we're seeing. Even when we look at a theater piece, we're seeing it in two dimensions. We see a proscenium, and we see, it's kind of a flat surface we're looking at. So it's two dimensions, but they tell a story in three dimensions. They tell it with height, with width, and with depth. And they do it in a way you can't put your finger on. The thing that impressed me about this scene, I mean, again, I watched it, but I didn't really study it. But I want to, there's a great line from The Big Chill. William Hurt says, sometimes you just have to let art flow over you. And I always remembered that, because sometimes you just have to let it hit you. And it's like when the tide comes in and goes out, it leaves something with you, and you have to try and take what it's left with you. And the thing that I got from this is this movie is a progression of absolute order moving into absolute chaos. And the more they try to maintain order, the more chaos grabs a hold and just shakes them. This scene is about chaos, and you see the structure with what they're doing, how a person goes there, a person goes there, a person does this, a person does that. And they're all doing multiple things because they have to do the job of several men. And that's one of the unspoken hallmarks of, I think, that war, was the way people just simply did the work of several people without complaint, without question, without sort of agonizing. They just did it because it needed to be done, and they were the ones who could do it, or they were the only ones who were doing it. If you look at the first scene, you've got them coming onto the beach, and there's, what are they called? The what boats?
Hedgehogs.
The boats. The bumming boats.
Oh, the LCTs or the LSTs?
No, the people carriers. It was made by the guy who made them.
Flat boats.
What are they called? And they open up like that. They were called the something boats. I can't remember his name. He was the guy who invented the boat. Yeah, it'll come to me. If you look it up while I'm talking, I can babble for another 30 seconds while you find it. You look at that, and there are rows and columns of men, and those boats would open up and they'd get mowed down, and they would just move forward and get mowed down, and they were trying to get to the beach and get mowed down. They had a very singular purpose, and there was order to what they were doing. Higgins boats, and yet they were just simply walking into chaos and kind of, like Mr. Spock going, I, bam, and they would just get taken out. This is chaos. They're already in chaos here. And the way they bring an order between themselves to that chaos is absolutely, it's breathtaking. Because when you're waiting for this to happen and you see that going on between these guys, it's just it's tension inducing. You don't get afraid, but you start to pray and you go, please, 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 please. And you can't articulate what it is you're seeing, but it just makes the knot in your stomach just tighten and tighten and tighten. And there's nothing about that except for the fact that this man is telling a story in the most brilliantly subtle and electrifying way. And that's why he's a great director. I mean, that's what I, when I was watching that scene again, I was going, I think I forgot to breathe. That you're just watching it and you kind of just there's no chance to relax, but there's nothing that's happening that's incredibly tense. It's not like you're trying to watch the jackal shoot De Gaulle. It's not one of those hold your breath things. You don't realize you're just frozen, but you're frozen. And that's just brilliant, brilliant storytelling.
Corey, as an actor, when you're on the set and you're filming a scene like this, right? And you're there with, you're getting the direction, you're getting everything, whether they're telling you what to do, you're doing your thing, whatever it is. And then, 6 months, a year later, you sit and you watch it in the theater. Just, how different is the experience?
Utterly, utterly, completely different.
Like, did
Because by the
you
time,
envision of what it's going to look like on the screen, or?
if you have experience, if you're a screenwriter, if you're a director, I would say, I think maybe Tom Hanks had an idea. I'm not certain that maybe Ed Burns had an idea. Ed Burns is a brilliant director in his own right, and he's a screenwriter as well. So it's entirely possible that Ed Burns, I think possibly Matt Damon looked at that and went, I've written Good Will Hunting. He had won the Oscar by this point, I think. And so there were guys there who were, and Vin Diesel, all these guys were film people. of the group, Tom Sizemore is the only one I would say who was a pure actor. That he just simply was an actor. He didn't direct, he didn't write, he was an actor. And his talent was for acting. And so while those guys may have suspected something, you can't know what's going on when you're in it. When you're in that heat, you can't know what else someone is thinking. And the other thing is he's passing it through one of the most brilliant cinematographers going. I think it was Janusz Kosminski. And his editing team,
Michael Cott.
these are, and John Williams is writing a soundtrack for it, if he's written anything at all. Sometimes you will get something like, for example, you have a brilliant editor, but that take was 40 seconds long. He didn't edit anything. Then that's the brilliance of his editing. He let that take roll. He let the take speak for himself. John Williams is a great orchestrator, a great composer, but there's no music behind that. All right. Then he felt that that was not the place for music. He let the tanks and the mud and the grit do the talking for him. That's a soundscape, and that's all down to a director whose job it is to know how to bring those elements together. And it's not, this is why I'm saying it's three-dimensional. It's not just about that moment. It's about the moments that have come before. It's about a moment that happened an hour ago that now is going to inform this moment you're seeing. And it's about moments that are yet to come, that he focuses on all of that at once, which is why I'm saying it's like three-dimensional chess. There are elements he's aware of that you cannot be aware of, no matter who you are. And so when you see it, I would say everybody went, oh my gosh, oh wow, because you have to. If you were saying, I knew he was going to do that, You weren't in that moment. You weren't there. You weren't where you were supposed to be when you were supposed to be there. You know,
right.
It's not about you walking through that mud, holding a rifle going, and this is where John's going to have that stinger. So I better pull the rifle up. You know, that's not your job. I think if they were aware and went, yeah, they weren't doing their jobs. You know,
right.
Part of the great thing. Yes, Christian, you were going to say something, and I'm about to go into three other stories. So go ahead.
I absolutely loved you throwing in the big chill. I hadn't thought about the big chill in forever. Now I'm going to have to go back and watch the big chill. We're doing an episode on Saving Private Ryan, and you throw in the big chill.
That's right. We could talk about
child
everything.
Of the 80s.
We could talk
about
everything.
I'm
a big Lawrence Kasdan fan, so that's fine.
Yeah,
well,
it's great.
Go ahead.
I love that.
I was going to tell you a story, a big chill story.
Yeah, the other thing I want to say is that you're talking about two things. One, what a great director Spielberg is and why. And, you're talking about, chaos. And one, on the chaos front, it is going, totally, chaotic. It goes from, like you said, calm, and they're sitting around just talking, mm-hmm. sharing stories, mm-hmm. to, more and more chaos. And that scene mm-hmm. is building, and you feel that sort mm-hmm. of panic, and he does beautifully build mm-hmm. that scene and takes mm-hmm. us right along, and it builds within you without even knowing it, right? And mm-hmm. that is what's so remarkable about his storytelling. But what stood out to me was how realistic it was, and you asked Theo this, and we're going to get to that episode later, how realistic it was based on Army experience. And I'm going to tell you, based on my experience when I've been around the Army and my own boys, what mm-hmm. I saw is that it is very realistic in how the Army teaches young men to deal with chaos in a moment. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they teach them and train them over and over and over and over again. They just mm-hmm. drill in routine to them. And mm-hmm. a lot of it is about just doing their job, just mm-hmm. doing their job. But mm-hmm. then also improvising mm-hmm. in any sort of situation. You don't mm-hmm. have what you need, so what's the next thing that you got to do? Mm-hmm. And, Hunter, my son, who is in the Army, talks about, a time when he was in Afghanistan where the truck in front of him, and I think it was a gas truck, got struck by a rocket. And the one guy next to him who was supposed to get out and do something just froze. And so he wasn't in charge, but he got a, fire extinguisher, got out of his car, and just kind of took control of the situation. Well, it wasn't his job or it wasn't his rank or whatever, but he did it. And, it reminded me yesterday, my youngest or third son was supposed to help my father move into this new facility and move out of another one. And there was a whole bunch of us. There was just chaos ranging, no one taking control. And he came in and just said, this is the way it's going to be. I have moved, I don't know how many times, and everybody listened to me. And he just took control and organized all of that chaos and every confusing thing that was sent his way. He dealt with it. So Jonah was organizing the chaos.
Yeah.
And anytime a problem would creep up, he would mm-hmm. just figure it out. And that's what I thought was so amazing. That's what he didn't know. I didn't teach him that.
Mm-hmm.
But the Army taught him that. And that's what I saw in that scene. Whenever there was one problem, they would just figure out a solution and move on to the next, solving the next problem.
Yeah.
And so Spielberg kept that authentic. And that's what I saw in that scene.
And I think he had a lot of great advice. I think, another thing that, I mean, these guys make movies about subjects that they know. They make movies about subjects that they're willing to learn about, and they make movies about subjects about which they can know nothing. But the commonality of all three of those is they want to tell a particular story, and they use the subject matter sometimes as a metaphor,
correct,
or as a field on which the story gets told. Which is, it's ballsy, because I got into acting because I felt like, it was like there were so many things I saw about actors and acting and why people act. And I remember Laurence Olivier said, acting is the art of persuasion. First, you persuade yourself, and then you persuade other people. And the operative word was persuade. It's not convince, it's not become, it's persuade. And the idea about that is like you say, you know, Mike Tyson has a great saying. He says, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the nose. And you can have things going along just the way you want it to until the truck in front of you blows up. And then you have to assess a brand new scene. You know, if you here you go. My favorite acting story is about the method actor who gets his first job. He has one line. Methinks I hear the cannons roar. He's going from the train to Washington to New York. He's memorizing his line. He's writing a backstory for his character. They get him in the thing. They're sewing him into the costume. The stage manager is grabbing him by the scruff of the neck. The whole time, for 4 hours, he's saying, methinks I hear the cannons roar. Methinks I hear the cannons roar. I love my father. I hate my mother. Methinks I hear the cannon. I'm married and I have 2 kids. Methinks I hear the. And they shove him on stage and he walks out onto the stage. And he's just about to open his mouth. He hears his cue. And right behind him, this enormous kaboom comes out. He jumps a mile in the air. He turns around. He says, what the fuck was that? The point being, I mean, it's a perfect acting story because he was so involved in his character that he forgot to be his character because he didn't know what the situation was. And, you know, that's the Tyson thing. He got punched in the nose and his plan went right out the window. Your son, if you think about it, didn't do the routine, didn't do what he was trained to do, but in a sense he did. He improvised and he made it up and he took control of the situation.
Yeah.
I
And
mean,
got a medal for valor too, I might
he
add.
should have. He should
Yeah.
have, because they should recognize stuff like that. You know, the danger of it is you will have a guy in a slightly different situation who does the same thing, who'll spend 30 days in the stockade.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things about military life is that you know you're trained to do certain things, but at the same time, I mean, the reason that you go over the same things over and over and over is for the muscle memory, but you also know
Right.
that if you're aware of everything else that's around you, then you know that you
Right.
can improvise when you need to.
Right. Well, that's what theater acting's about.
Right.
You know,
That's
theater acting is
true.
you learn it, you learn it, you learn it, and then you can make something up when something funny happens because you're in
Right.
control of it.
Yeah. Exactly.
You
That's
know,
why it's
exactly.
great to do improv with the theater training.
I got myself in huge trouble because somebody said, "Oh yeah, I'm taking a what is it?" He said, "I teach an improv class," and I went. Pfft. And he went, and he was really offended. And I went, well, you're saying, you know, kind of along the lines of spontaneity has its time and place, you know? And he says, no, you can teach improv. And the more he talked, the more I was just stifling this laugh because I was saying, you can teach improv in the same way you can teach someone how to act, but they won't be an actor. Being an actor is about doing something else. You know, you can learn, you can read every book on Stanislavski. It does not make you an actor.
That's
Some
true.
someone can teach you how to improvise, but it doesn't make you improvisational,
That's
you
true
know?
too.
And
I think it's
so,
a gift.
well, it yes and no. It yes, it of course
It
it is.
is. It's a
Of
gift
course
and
it
a
is.
curse.
But
Yes.
it's like saying, I look, you oversimplify it, and we're getting into improvisation now. You oversimplify it by saying, if you can have a conversation, you can improvise. Because there's no way I would have said 45 minutes into our podcast or a half hour into our podcast, we would be discussing improvisation. We're supposed to be talking about Private Ryan, but that's the way the conversation went. And the fact that we're on top of it and there are no unnatural pauses, that we're filling in the conversation, means we're listening, we're paying attention, we're responding, you know, everybody's playing their part. You
Exactly.
know, no one's trying to talk over anybody else. Everybody's just letting it happen, you know. So I think we all know how to improvise. It's just a question when there's a camera on the other side or an audience on the other side, it becomes exponentially more difficult. And that is where the training comes in.
Correct.
Well, it
But the
becomes more
best
difficult
training.
training.
You also have to know, as you said earlier this week, you have to know who the director is, whether the director is going to be willing to
Yeah.
accept your advice or your improvisation or not. There are,
Yeah.
you know,
Yeah.
you told us a story about the guy sweeping the floor. You know,
Yeah. Yeah.
you know,
Yeah.
if you're,
Yeah.
some people are willing to take that and some people are not. Right. And you
and
have to
I think
you
true.
have to know your audience.
You've heard the story about Kevin Costner and Gene Hackman on No Way Out?
Nope.
No,
Go
I
ahead.
love that movie. Oh my
Okay,
gosh, I
it is.
love
It's
that
a great. It's
movie.
a great movie. It's a great movie. They have scenes in Gene Hackman's office where Gene Hackman is sitting behind a desk. Kevin Costner is in front of the desk, and they do the whole thing, and they do it. And the director says this last climactic scene, they want it in the same way. And Kevin Costner just went, no. I'm sorry, this scene has to be over. We've done everything. He says, we've done it all right here. He says, that's exactly why it's got to be now over here. This isn't the same thing. It's over. And they were arguing for like 15, 20 minutes. And finally, one of the things the director said was, he said, look, what's Gene going to do? And he went, Gene will figure it out. And he said, it's got to be. And he didn't mean to be like dismissive, but he just was like, I'm arguing my point. You can't. And so they shot the scene and they wrapped for the day. You know, they did some takes and everything. And he goes, and I'm walking to my car. I'm on the Universal thing was Culver City lot or something, Studio City. So I'm walking to my car and he says, Gene's about 50 yards away. And he goes, hey, come here. And I walk over there and he says, don't you ever, ever talk to me like that again on the set. And the guy looks at him and he goes, he didn't say that. I thought he was going to say that. He looked at me and he said, you know, I've been doing this a long time and I've won some awards and I've made some questionable choices. I've made some questionable pictures in the last few years. What you did today, fighting for your corner, reminded me of why I got into this. He said, it was good. Keep doing it. He got in his car and he left.
Wow.
Wow.
You know, that is why you do stuff like that. And a great director will go, yes, but a great director won't ever put you in a position where you've got to fight him for 20 minutes.
Right.
That's
You
true.
true. There's something to
I
that.
mean, a truly great director. Look, Star Wars, there's no question Star Wars is a great movie. Is George Lucas a great director? I don't know. He's made a handful of great films, but he stopped making films a long, long time ago.
In the galaxy far, far away.
Right. And Harrison Ford looks at Princess Leia and she says, I love you. And the line was written, I love you too. And he said, he would never say that. And so he said, and without telling George Lucas, he said, I
Know.
know. And George Lucas lost his mind. And Harrison Ford just went, it's what he would do. It's what makes him, you know?
And
And
he was
so
right.
he was right. You know, audience, everybody proves that he was right. But the director, and this is what I'm saying about these guys in three dimensionality, a truly great director will get that from an actor, and it will be another piece of something that only he's aware wasn't there. And he'll go, yes, I like that. Instead of going, no, instead of it needs to be this, it needs to be ordered. I know it's chaos. This is how we do chaos. It's not chaos. I mean, everybody's going to do it in a slightly different way. Again, the thing I loved about it was the order that he brought to that chaos and the way he brought chaos to order. You know, he did the inverse, which is what brilliant acting is, what brilliant directing is, you know. In the moment before the scene, you see Matt Damon laughing so hard he's almost crying.
Yeah.
The brilliance of that he is so abandoned in whatever they were laughing at that he's almost in tears, tells you what kind of emotional edge he was walking on a daily basis. And you can't buy that. All you can do is hope it comes out and be there when it does so you can film it.
But think about that emotional arc. Think about that emotional arc. What intensity. I mean, think about the writing. Think about all of that coming together in that moment. You know, you think
Right.
about all the guys, you know, looking for Private Ryan. This is what all this is building to. All of a sudden, they find him in this field. There he is. It's just a, oh, your brother is dead. You know, he's got to deal with
I
that.
hear my
You know,
dog.
which one? Well, all of them, you know, and here he is thinking about his brothers. What's he supposed to do with that? You know, and Tom Hanks is telling him how to deal with it. And he's got to, you know, you got to think about it. You got to think of a specific thing. And the next thing you know, he's sitting there talking to Tom Hanks's character about, something specific, the last time he was with his brothers and what happens. He breaks out into this unbelievable laughter, right? It's so unbelievable and genuine and real. And it is in this private, unabandoned, calm moment, right? And you're right. At the edge of emotion. And the next thing, everything explodes.
Right.
You know, and, you know, they're in this world of absolute, you know, chaos on the edge of death. And the intensity is building. And we're wondering, are they going to make it? And is he going to die too?
I've been in movies, for obvious reasons, not going to tell you which ones they were, where a director has walked into a set holding a script in his hands, and he says, okay, here's what we're going to shoot today. And he throws the script up in the air behind him and goes, what are we going to do? And then the screenwriter gets nominated for an Oscar, and you have to congratulate him on his screenplay.
That's right.
Because even though somebody had to get nominated, somebody had to go down as the screenwriter, but it's just he gave the idea of a scene. And we fleshed out the meat on the scene, on the bones.
Correct.
And so, yeah. But again, you know, he probably went, thank you. You know, what you did bore no resemblance to what I wrote. But it's like, no. That's all. You gave us that idea, you know. And that, I think, is, you know, one of the brilliant things. Again, Steven Spielberg, you can't be a director and not understand actors. You can't be a director and not understand cameras. You can't be a director and not understand script writers. You can't be a director and not understand continuity or lighting or props or costumes. If you're a director, you have to understand everything. It's your job. You know, there are a lot of directors who go, I'll leave that to you. Look, as an actor, I do that, but I do it in a way that I can live with. When I have a costume fitting, they will bring a rack of clothes in. Sometimes it's literally 15 feet long. And there are shirts and pants and jackets and shirts and clothes and shoes and this. I've been taken to the Ralph Lauren shop on New Bond Street, which was one of the best times I ever had. But, you know, because you sit there and you're sitting in a fitting room and they bring something in and you go, hang that one up there. And then they bring another thing in and you go, not that. And then they bring another thing and you go, wrong color. And they go, okay, that and that. And if we have one more, maybe in a gray, and they bring something gray in and you hold it up and you go, sorry, gray's not right. It's this, what color is that? Midnight blue. Okay, that's amazing. That's fun. But I sit there and eliminate 80% of what I see before I've even put it on. And I know people who will go, I'm going to try everything on because I don't know. And I'm going, that's great. That's fine. I know what I want.
Right.
I know who my guy is. Even when I don't, I know who he is.
Right. I just watched today the 40th anniversary special with, you know, the five actors from The Breakfast Club.
I was going to say The Breakfast Club. Because you said 40th anniversary. I went 1985. Got to be The Breakfast Club. Yeah.
That's right. So I just watched that today. And one of the stories that Molly Ringwald tells there is of John Hughes, that when, you know, she got to the set, they had the wardrobe. She had the name of the, you know, the woman in charge of costumes, and she picked out all these things, and she, Molly Ringwald said, she's looked at it and said, this is, none of this stuff is what Claire would wear. And she said that to John Hughes, and John Hughes says, okay, let's go shopping. And they went to the mall, and
the mall,
they picked out stuff that Molly Ringwald felt that Claire would wear. And I mean, again, it's an iconic movie, and it's an iconic, you know, wardrobe of what she has, because you believe the characters more based on the way that they present themselves and the way that they're dressed.
Yeah.
You know, from that perspective.
Well, she should get a costume award because she did a great job.
Yeah.
I think it's a little late.
And it tells you something. It tells you something about, I mean, I don't feel like we're getting off the subject because
we're not.
You know, when we talk about directors and the relationship to directors and actors, you look at some of those actors in The Breakfast Club, literally, there were five major actors and, you know, five teens. You could make a case that three of them really didn't do much after The Breakfast Club or didn't do much outside of that character that they created.
Correct.
Emilio Estevez certainly did. And
well, he moved into screenwriting and directing.
But he was still an actor. He still did some acting.
Rob Lowe did. Demi Moore did.
Rob Lowe wasn't in it.
Rob Lowe wasn't in it.
You're thinking of St. Elmo's Fire.
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking St. Elmo's Fire.
Yes. Right. Judd Nelson did some television, but never became the kind of film actor that he gave notice for in that movie.
Right.
Anthony Michael Hall ran out of gas almost immediately after that movie.
He did a few more. He did 16 Candles.
That was
did,
before.
No, the
16
16
Candles
Candles
came
was
out before
before.
in 84.
82, 83, yeah, something
No,
like that, yeah.
84 was 16 Candles and 85
84,
was
right. And
the...
84 was St. Elmo's Fire as well. You know,
No,
so
St.
The
Elmo's Fire was
Breakfast
85.
Club,
St. Elmo's Fire came out the same year.
85, same year. But The Breakfast Club was kind of, the St. Elmo's Fire and The Breakfast Club were kind of the peak of that Brat Packish type of
That's
thing. You know, you then moved into, you had things like Andrew McCarthy doing Less Than Zero, or Andrew McCarthy doing, what was it, not 16
Mannequin.
Candles,
Mannequin.
Mannequin. Andrew McCarthy did a few things, but he couldn't get past that thing. Demi Moore was one of the only ones. Mare Winningham is a great actress, and she had a lot of difficulty, you know, sort of catching on after, because she was an actor. She was a character actor at a young age. But a lot of those guys were so identified with their iconic roles that they couldn't break out of that stuff because it came at the ideal time in the ideal place for them where they were, you know? And it's tough to move beyond that. By the time Private Ryan came along, Steven Spielberg had been a force in directing for 25 years.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a career by any other name. And you think about it now, Private Ryan is now almost 30 years old.
I
That's right.
know.
27 years old does
And
a
so Steven Spielberg has been going, he's had a 50 plus year career.
Hey,
You know?
this year is 50 years to Jaws. So there you go.
Right.
Wow.
And you know,
Crazy.
you just, that's amazing. You know, yeah. And Duel was what, 72, 73?
Duel was 71.
I can remember watching one of the first episodes of Columbo.
Yes, he directed
And
one episode of Columbo.
do
I
you know
love
who
that
wrote
show.
the episode he directed?
I used
Who?
to. I
How do you
forgot. I
know
watched
this
it. I
stuff?
watched it
How
last
do
year.
you know
You
this
don't
stuff?
forget it when you see this.
I saw it. I forgot it. How do you know this
Stephen
stuff?
Bochco.
Bochco. That's right.
I don't even.
Okay.
I don't even know who that is.
He did
What?
Hill Street
Hill Street
Blues. He did
Blues.
Saint Elsewhere. L.A. Law.
That's
Oh
right.
my word. I need
The
an
television of
education.
the 80s, Stephen Bochco did.
That's right.
Yeah, where were you in the 80s? What were you
I was
doing?
I was in boarding school. I was in boarding school and we didn't have television. That was problem number one. And then by that time, 84 to 88, I was in college, but I didn't watch television because I was too busy in theater school doing plays.
Yeah. What theater school was that?
That was your theater school.
Well, let's continue with what's going on here. So we have this scene that Corey has now explained to us is purposeful chaos. You know, where you have Henderson and
Yes.
Mellish just running around, looking around, trying to figure out where the enemy's coming, setting up the you know setting up the 30 caliber machine gun. You have Upham in the background with them. You see Germans trying to inch closer to them, and they just open fire and just start shooting at them. And Upham just gets out of there. He runs
Right.
across the room and looks out a window and almost gets shot. You know, because the and again the scene just flows so well with the way that they're doing this. Then you know we then they show us what's going on the ground also. And you know we have Ryan and Miller shooting at the Germans that are coming. A lot of chaos, a lot of smoke. And then you know we reach a point where we have two guys that inch towards the tank and they're getting their sticky bombs ready, and they quickly light them, and you know as the tank moves past them, they find a way to you know attach their sticky bombs to two of the wheels, which it's great the way that they do that, and then we see the wheels you know go around and just blow up and take out the tread, and
Yeah.
we even see you know Miller jump on top of Ryan to protect him a little more, you know, as
Yeah.
this is going on, which
Yeah.
again,
Little tiny details like that, you know, and when you tell the story of it in a linear fashion, you do get the idea, but there's nothing that can capture the essence of how he films this, you know? We're going to talk about this later on when we get into his movies, because the movies that he's done that I like, I want to talk about some other scenes in some other ones. But just the detail, there is no detail too small for him. There is nothing that, I mean, you know, we talk about purposeful chaos. There is nothing he does that doesn't have what he believes will be a reason or a rationale. Even if he looks at it and says, yeah, it didn't work the way I thought it would, and doesn't use it, it doesn't keep him from shooting it. It doesn't keep him from trying to set it up. I told you the thing about Tom Sizemore's helmet, right? You know, they did the take and it flipped off, and I went, well, that take was a disaster. And then he does one that's absolutely perfect. The helmet stays on his head. He puts the take with the helmet falling off, and it's the one everyone talks about. His helmet came off, and he just reached up and grabbed and put it back on. It was like he looked like an idiot when it was happening, but Spielberg's seeing something else.
Do you
You
think he
know?
sees it?
He
Do you think he sees it as it's happening,
sees it.
or he sees it when he's going through the dailies?
I don't know. That's a great question. That's a great question, because there's something I want to believe that there is something in him that even when he's shooting it is able to look and go, because you have to. I've trusted the actor, I've trusted the cameraman, I've trusted the sound guy to do their jobs. Now I am going to look at it as a director doing my job, which is to tell a story. What is the story this tells? Instead of going, okay, and now he comes here and this, and it's a mess. And he comes over here and says, okay, so action. And he looks at it and he goes, no, the helmet fell off. And as soon as you see that, you're out of whatever element you need to be in order to tell the story you're looking to tell. And he manages, either, like you said, in that moment or later in the rushes, to go, that was the take. That was the one. The worst thing I can say about that is it happened first. So he took another one just to make sure he had another one.
Right.
But when he got that second one, he went, one of them's going to be fine. I would think it was going to be, he thought the second one was going to be fine and went, that first one is genius. It's going to work. But something in me is saying he went, I've got two, and both of them are different, but both of them are equally brilliant. And so, you know, yeah. What an interesting question that was, though.
Yeah, because
Because
again, I mean,
you
yeah, you
don't
have.
want, well, you think of them one of two ways. Look, directors are a creation of the 20th century. There was no such thing as a stage director, and there was no such thing as cinema in the 19th century, really. There was no such thing as a stage director before sort of the late 1800s. You know, it's the last 125 years. Actors have been around for 3,000 years. I have immense faith in actors. I have next to no faith in directors. You know, I used to say that the best, we did a class at the BBC, and this is 30 years ago. I said, what advice can you give a director? I said, cast well
Stay
and then get the hell out of my way. You know, if you cast me, get out of my way and let me do my job. I'm not going to tell you how to direct. Don't tell me how to act. You know?
Okay, makes sense.
But it's the hardest thing in the world to do.
Right,
You know,
of
it's
course.
just like it's hard to trust the director. But when somebody is a genius, it becomes apparent to you. You know, it's not that you just respect them and behind their back going, he doesn't listen to a word I say. He doesn't, you know.
No, but
You go,
I'm assuming you've been on movies, and you're obviously not going to tell us which ones, and that's fine. Okay, that you've been in
sure, I'll
movies
tell you a couple of them.
where the director is just doesn't know what he's
An
doing.
idiot? An idiot? No, some directors know exactly what they're doing. They're still idiots. I had a director who did this to me. I had two conversations with him. The first one, I said, "You like these red cameras?" They were new then. I said, "You like these red cameras?" Conversation started, right? He looked at me and went, "I'm using them, ain't I?" And walked off. I was like, "Oh, this is going to be hard." So a few weeks later, I walked up to him and I was just looking at something. I said, "Can I ask you a question?" He said, "You just did." I walked away. I was like, "I'm done with you now. I'm done. I don't need that. Life's too short, do you know? For me to work that hard to have a conversation with you, you cast me." And he did. I heard him do this. He did this to someone else before he did it to me. And when he did it to me, I had a ball. I heard him say to another actor, it was a German actor who spoke English. he said, listen, we're going to have to shoot this scene this afternoon. And it was a scene where he had a page-long monologue that wasn't supposed to be shot for 2 weeks. And he was taking time to learn it. And they said, we're shooting it this afternoon. So he needed to learn it in like 4 hours. And English was not his first language. And so he didn't eat lunch. He's sitting there in his trailer hammering this thing out. And he goes through it and he memorized it. The whole thing, he did it like one long, it was like 30 seconds or, I mean, like a minute monologue. And he did it. And the director went, okay, cut. Let's go back. We're going to do it again. Just loosen up. Just loosen it up. And he says, take two, take three. He's giving him direction every time. Take five, take seven. And now the guy is starting to get really addled because he doesn't know what it's, if it's good, if it's not. And then the director comes up to him and says, listen to me, listen to me. If you can do this, that's going to be great. If you can't do this, so help me God, I will cut you out of my movie. And I heard him say that. And I was like, I almost went off on him and I just held back. And then like 2 weeks later, he did it to me. He said, you can do this, great. If you can't, so help me, I will cut you out of my movie. I said, cut me out of your movie. Cut me out of your movie. Go ahead. You want to see if I can do it? Roll the camera. I'm going to do it one more time. Otherwise, cut me out of your movie. And he just looked at me. He was kind of shocked. I went, cut me out. I don't care. Cut me out. I'm getting paid. Cut me out. You know, I don't know what kind of story you're going to tell. Cut me out. We did it one more time. That was it. Then we went on. He never spoke to me again after that. And I didn't want to talk to him. The man
was.
Did
he cut you out?
No, he didn't cut me out. He couldn't. I was part of the story.
Or you're the lead actor. Yeah.
No, yeah. I was the lead actor. No, he was my brother. No, you know.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Who was the best director you've ever worked with?
I mean, when you say there's directors I've worked for, and there are directors I have worked with. I worked for Steven Spielberg. I didn't work with him. He asked me to do some stuff and I did some stuff. Do you know? Ridley Scott, I worked for Ridley Scott, but I watched them work. And when you see Ridley Scott had a tent, a Video Village tent in the middle of a football stadium. He had helicopters and tanks driving in and landing, and there were thousands of people there. And you go, this is just, it's, I can't even imagine. This is like spectacle. This is like, you know, it's just incredible. And so you go, the man is like, he's a genius. He's just a genius. And then there are guys who I've worked, really worked with them. I've worked with a lot of European directors, worked with a lot of foreign directors. Some of them are really great. I don't know if they're on the level of Ridley Scott or Steven Spielberg, but they're really, really great because they care and they're passionate about what they're doing. And some of them, and you'd be surprised by this, don't care beyond what the title of their movie suggests you need to care about.
What do you mean by that?
Okay. If you're making a movie about a person, that's the person he's concerned with. And I understand that it's an important, crucial person in the story. But that person, if they're a human being, is shaped and formed by the people around them, informed by the people around them. And to have someone, to have a director who is just worried about what someone is doing, and not able to convey to someone else what they need to be doing, is unforgivable.
Right.
It's unforgivable. It's like saying, it would be the equivalent of saying, sound, I don't care about the sound. Let me see the camera. Give me, oh, these lenses are beautiful. No, tip it, microphone, I don't care. You're not going to have a whole picture. You're going to have this really tinny, crappy sound and this beautiful, lush lens that's not going to, you know, be image that's not going to work. You need to be concerned with the whole thing. And there are brilliant, brilliant, brilliant men and women. Have I ever worked with a woman director? No. The only female director I've worked with is Mimi Leader, who was pretty damn great.
What movie did you work with her in?
It was called The Code. with Antonio Banderas and Morgan Freeman. Tom Hardy was in it. Robert Forster was in it.
Okay, I actually think I have seen it. I don't remember it,
Yeah,
but I've seen
it's, you have seen it then. If you don't remember it, you have seen it.
it.
But she was quite a formidable director. And when I saw that she was involved in a big way with the morning show, I went, of course. There was a show a few years ago called Harry, what was it? Patrick Dempsey was in it. I can't remember what it was. Damn, Jean-Jacques Annaud directed it. Directed the first episode. He had a lot to do with it. And I did a movie with him that was, it wasn't a great movie, but he was really a brilliant, brilliant director. Because he loved actors. Loved actors. Any actor. He just loved actors. And it's wonderful working for a guy like that because you want to go to war with him. You want to go to war with him, The thing about Steven Spielberg is he was just unimpeachably a genius. He was a genius, but never sort of, was like, I'm an auteur. We must I have to have my moment and now we can work. He was just like, how you doing? Hey, how's everything? Good, good. Yeah.
Good
Okay,
guy.
let's just a normal guy. Let's do some work today, How I would imagine Ron Howard is as well.
Okay.
I'd love to work for Ron Howard because I just think there's something about him that you go, he's just a normal guy, but he's doing abnormal things, with his work. So,
Right. The thing about Spielberg in this movie is that, I mean, this was like his dream for 40 years to make this movie. Anyone who's seen
Wow.
The Fablemans knows, that even as a teenager, he was making World War II movies. He wanted to make an impactful World War II movie, and he didn't do one, he did two. From completely different direction.
Exactly.
There are very few directors who've ever been able to achieve what he's achieved. But
I don't think hardly any. When you think like there were guys like Preston Sturges and John Ford back in the day, but they didn't go outside their milieu, They did what they knew. They did what they wanted to do. John Ford was all about horizon and this long flat country with a sole figure on it.
Again,
And it,
anyone
you
who's
know,
seen
it's the
Fablemans
very right. Isn't that a
knows
great story?
that
But where's the horizon? And there were guys who did their thing, They did what they knew. Spielberg has ventured so far away from what he seems to know
Correct.
that you have to assume that it with him it's about something
I
else.
think it's the challenge. I mean, come on, that's got to be the reason why he did West Side Story.
Well,
You have a guy who's done so many movies, and he's finally going to go do a musical, and he chooses one of the best musicals ever to remake, and does an amazing job with it that, it's almost comparable, if not surpassing slightly, the original.
That you see, I would, yeah. It would be like if someone tried to do Jaws again. I just don't think you were going to catch that lightning in the bottle twice, no matter who you are. But kudos for him for trying. But I think at one point there is an idea that he's looking for a challenge. I think in a weird way, I feel like challenges are for someone to figure out what it is they're capable of. And I think Steven Spielberg knows exactly what he's capable of. It's just how he's going to tell it. And again, that's why I think he's lasted. I think that's why he's got such a long career, because it is for him, storytelling is paramount. People want to say, oh, it's about camera tricks, and it's about he does one shot in Jaws, and he does sort of light in Close Encounters, and all of a sudden it's, oh, it's about smoky light and shafts of light and camera tricks, and it's not,
No, of course
and he
not.
knows that.
It's about
Those
telling the
aren't
story of the
signature things for him.
Indianapolis.
Yeah,
That's what it is.
exactly. Exactly. That they just had that on what was it? Was it today? Yeah, it's today, 50 years or something. Or he said it was 50 years ago or something that this was the greatest monologue ever captured on celluloid. You know, we
Robert
delivered
Shaw.
the bomb.
Robert
Oh
Shaw
my
was amazing,
God.
especially in that movie.
Yeah.
I love Muscle and Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, but
Yeah. Those are great movies too, you know.
As we're finishing up this minute, so we're back with Henderson and Mellish, still taking pot shots at all the Germans through the huge gaping hole in the wall. It always makes me wonder every time I see this, what the hell happened in Rommel? Like, who bombed Rommel? Was it the Allies or was it the Germans? But they gave them the perfect spot in order to shoot from. Which is just great the way that they do it. And the whole time they're just trying to figure out what to do. And Mellish is trying to save Upham at the time. He's screaming, get down, Upham, dirty gal, hurry, and find the captain. His flank's gonna fold. They know that they can't last that much longer in this particular space. And again, the whole point of this scene is to tell us, that even amidst all this chaos or whatever, they're gonna be moving from place to place.
That was the other thing. It's not about this is where
Not
we make our
stationary.
last stand.
That's right.
This is the first place of our last stand. And then we roll, and then we roll back, and then we roll, and we're waiting for something to come, something bigger to come in the other direction, so we can start going forward, which is what happens. You know?
Exactly.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
One of the things that I've mentioned about the way that the whole Battle of Rommel works is that we see the geography of the entire town beforehand. And then during the battle, we get to see where they're moving from. And you're like, oh, okay, I remember that they were in the clock tower, and the clock tower is the position of the clock tower is in relevance to where they're on the ditch, and you have the street, and you have okay, and this is their position, and that's their position, and we know how they're going to get to the Alamo, and they have to cross the bridge, and like all these little things. And then as the movie progresses, we see all of these particular spots. I mean, I always use Titanic as the perfect example of a director telling the audience what's going to happen without them really even knowing that they're being told it. You have the whole point where, they're quickly telling the story of what happened, using the computer graphics. They say, okay, hit the iceberg at this and this time, and it broke in two, and it was bobbing up, and the water was going into there. And then as you're watching the movie, you're like, wait a second, this all sounds so familiar. And the idea is to allow the audience to, when they're watching the movie, not to have to think about all the stuff. It's there in your mind already. And now you can pay attention to the story of everything else that's going on, between Jack and Rose.
Rose, exactly.
How many men from their little group did they lose during this battle?
In this
Wait,
group,
which group?
they lost the Saving Private Ryan group. They lost Giovanni Ribisi and Vin Diesel
Okay, that's Wade and Caparzo.
before.
That's right.
Who did they lose in this battle?
They lost
Let's see what if you know it, Dakota.
Mellish.
Yeah.
Mellish. Well,
Well, we
they
haven't watched
lost
them yet. Alan
they lost all right what's his name? Adam Goldberg. Is that
Goldberg
his
is
name?
Mellish. He's
Adam
Mellish.
Goldberg. They lost Tom Sizemore. They lost
Mike.
Tom Hanks.
Okay, Miller.
They lost
One more. One more.
Barry Pepper.
Jackson. There you go. There's
Yeah,
four.
Barry
There's
Pepper.
four of them that get lost. So
Ed
of the.
Burns, Ed Burns, and Ed Burns, and Upham and Private Ryan are the only ones who survive.
Right. Well, okay. Ryan is not part of the original group,
No,
but
but yeah.
Upham
Upham and
and
Mike.
Riven. No, Upham and Riven
Riven,
are
Pete.
the exactly are the two that make it out. Richard Riven and Timothy Upham. Those are their.
Richard
That's what I thought.
Riven.
That's what I
Okay,
thought.
okay.
Yeah,
You know,
and.
I told you what my favorite moment in Private Ryan is, in the
Yes.
English teacher scene.
Yes.
Yes.
when they're threatened, he says, I'm not gonna beat him. I'm gonna shoot his, and he says it with such glee, I'm gonna shoot his head off. I'm gonna shoot his face off.
Because
You
I
know,
don't
it's
like
just
you.
like, no, he doesn't, yeah, because I don't like you. And he's, what's the betting on me? What's how I do? And he says, I'm an English teacher, I teach English. And they're all looking at him like, what the hell is going on now? And Sizemore just really quietly, he just looks and says, please don't go. And it's the most wonderfully heartbreaking thing because you just go, these are grown men. And they've been asked to do a difficult thing. But they've been asked, the only thing, the only relationship they have as human beings to this is the games they used to play when they were kids. And they're playing those games. They play those games with one another all the time because it's the way that they keep. It's the only way you can trust someone that you don't know like that immediately and completely. And when he says, please don't go, it's just you realize after threatening to blow his, because I don't like you and I'm going to take this opportunity to beat the crap. And then he just says, please, he says. You know, you said Richard Ryben is his first name. I'm listening to that scene and I thought he said, Pete, don't go. But he says, please don't go. Because you can just hear this explosive P, and it's just the most breathtaking. It's the most breathtaking thing. One of the most breathtaking things I've seen. I told him that. I said that to Tom Sizemore. I said, you know, that was just huge.
Well, and that for me sums up, this is why I asked you how many guys, survive, because that bookends exactly my point. You start with that scene, which demonstrates right there. You're right, Corey. You're right. These are brothers. Over the course of their time together, they've formed this bond. They've kind of grown up in this family where they've wrestled like tiger cubs with each other. They're
Exactly.
biting and they're fighting and they're,
Right.
they don't know it.
Loving.
Yeah,
Yeah.
they don't know it, but they've become brothers. And
Right.
they have this love-hate relationship with one another, and
Right.
they are bonded, they're trauma bonded, and here they are now, kind of talking and relaxing and taking in this, that they found Ryan, where they finally found him, and he's absorbing this bad news, and they're just making sense of what the situation they found themselves in, because now they have to be in this battle where the odds are against them, and they're going to stand by Ryan, and you just see how the writing and the directing builds us to this moment of now losing just about everybody for this mission, but Ryan and two of the guys that came to save him. I mean, I get emotional just thinking about that. Like, it just, that storytelling just rips your heart out,
Yeah, it does.
because
It
you
does.
think about that deep irony of them. Gosh, you just think about how it just rips your heart out. You have this moment, this
And
moment of them being in the field together, and you get bonded when you listen to him talk about Miller, talk about his family and about being an English teacher. And you can picture what his normal life is like, and you listen to how, he just gets their attention, and it's that real moment where, it stops everything.
It
It
does.
stops
It
everything
does.
in a moment in time, and it brings them all back to reality that they're real people with real lives outside of this crazy thing that they've all been thrown in, right? And it again, it makes you realize that they are people. It makes us realize that they're people, right? And so we care about them. And then the story that Ryan is telling about his brothers. Oh my goodness, like that story. And you see his laughing. And by the time that the battle begins to explode and they begin to die, I thought I was gonna die. And that kind of storytelling is why I can't watch that movie. I mean, it's that's what's
There's
so
because
great though about
they make
Stephen
it
King.
feel so personal. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, they do. And that's why I love his storytelling, because he can tell those war stories, but with a heart. And truthfully, I watched those movies, that and Band of Brothers, and that is what inspired my own filmmaking. Because when I went to Normandy, you know, what I saw, and I say this, I don't know how many times, I didn't see a war story. I saw a love story. You know, I saw a love story between the people of Normandy and the GIs who liberated them, you know, and I saw individual stories because each GI made a difference in the lives of those Normandy people. And they touched them and they changed them, you know. And war is terrible and horrible. And you see, you know, these politicians make decisions and they play games with people's lives. And that impacts all of us all around the world. And even though there are all these horrible things that happen because of it, there also can be really wonderful things in the midst of it. And that's what I saw in Normandy, and that's what I wanted to tell, you know. And so that's what is redeeming, I think. There are redeeming things too in these difficult stories, and I think Spielberg brings those out, as does Tom Hanks.
The brilliance of what I think Spielberg does, there was an idea about acting, you know, when I was talking about Olivier, all these ideas you take away from it being the art of persuasion. Someone else said great acting is unpredictable yet inevitable. And it sounds like a contradiction. You can't have inevitability being unpredictable. If it's inevitable, it's going to happen anyway. It's the unpredictable nature of it that you go, it might not happen. And then when it does, you go, it's like, oh, of course. It's not like a one-off event. It's a seismic event because of its inevitability. But the unpredictability of it makes it shocking when it happens. Spielberg does that with everything he makes. When he was brilliant, and I think he still is, when he is brilliant, he manages to make you think things are going one way and then literally bisect you by taking them. And again, it's not just, it's going across and coming at you at a completely other angle. It's three-dimensional what he does. The scene where, you know, what am I, what's the betting on me? What about my job? Back, what's the betting? What's the betting? He's almost getting cross. There are two of his men who are holding guns, and everybody else is yelling, and he just all of a sudden really quietly kind of says, what's the bet? What is it? What is it? What is it? Okay. Okay. All right. I'm a school teacher. Teach English. And it's not maudlin. It's not. It's just like you go, this guy's cracking up. And so the scene has gone from being one about anger to being about, this is becoming surreal. Have I like walked into the middle of a Salvador Dali painting? And then Tom Sizemore says, please don't go. And it's just like the tiniest little thing, this little moment that happens. And you go, oh my goodness, it's just breathtaking. All those things were Steven Spielberg giving you stories, telling you things. In one moment, he tells three different stories. And that's why it's a great film. Because in one moment, in one scene, in 1 minute, he tells you six different things about 12 different people.
Right.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a miracle for that reason.
That's the way that this minute ends. When, you know, we'll have to see on Monday, you know, where these guys end up going. You know, we have, again, Upham, Mellish, and Henderson stuck in the room trying to figure out what they're going to do.
You don't want me to spoil anything, do you?
Well, you guys have already spoiled it by telling, you know, by going through how many people are going to die. But that's
yeah, sorry about that.
No, but you asked. I just spouted information. That's what I do.
Christian, my assumption is that anyone who's listening to this podcast has probably already seen the movie.
Probably seen it, yeah,
and
yeah.
Knows what's going
to
happen.
A podcast about Private Lion. I've never seen that. Maybe I'll listen to the podcast for it. No,
that's
I don't
right.
think so.
Exactly. That's right.
Yeah.
The way it is. So because Corey unfortunately wasn't with us on Wednesday and Thursday, we're going to do the Wednesday and Thursday segments once again for Corey. I mean, we already have Christian's answers, but now we're going to get Corey.
Great.
So
great.
We'll start with Wednesday's World War II Wednesday. So this segment is about Corey's top five World War II movies. Start with your number five and work your way up.
I hate this. I hate starting with my number five because
you start with your number six.
He can't do the numbers in order.
No,
we already learned
this. I can give you my top five, but they won't be in any order.
You do them in chronological order. Isn't that what you told
And
me?
my first one is going to be Private Ryan because I'm in it and it's, always fun doing that. And, like I said, when they showed the clip from the Oscar broadcast, they showed me and Tom Hanks, and my dad immediately called me on the phone and said, "Okay, you've now your career is made because you've been on the Oscars podcast for Private Ryan with Tom Hanks." I was like, "Great. Me or my dummy?" He said, "No, you and the dummy, both of you." I was like, "Good. Okay, great. Cool." The next two
Wait, are you going
are both
up to top to bottom or bottom to top?
I'm just giving you my top
No,
five.
I
I'm
know
not
that,
going to
but
give them to you
I need
in
to
an
give I need to
yeah.
give them I
Okay.
give points
You
to each
can
of them. So where do you want me to
you
give the
oh
points?
oh man. Well, this stinks. No, I don't want you to give any points to Private Ryan or give him the lowest points because it's going to get the most points from people anyway. It's a great movie.
How about you tell your movies and then you can order them?
Okay, that's a good idea. So Private Ryan is one of them.
Okay.
The next two are very they're genre movies. I think they're genre movies because there was an idea that and I think it's the truth. They wrote a book, I think it was Tom Brokaw wrote a book called The Greatest Generation about the soldiers in World War II, about how these men did, they were ordinary men doing the most extraordinary thing. And both these movies were sort of, they were ordinary men and they did extraordinary things, but they weren't sort of normal. They were kind of abnormal people or doing an abnormal thing, but it sort of encapsulated war. I'm talking about Kelly's Heroes and The Dirty Dozen.
Oh, great, great choices.
And those have what you would call all-star casts. Just
I've never seen either one of those.
okay,
Christian, I think we're
you
kicking you out
probably
for this podcast at this point.
you'll love Kelly's Heroes, and you may have trouble with The Dirty Dozen.
right.
But you should watch both of them because they do completely different things in brilliant ways. And you've got to understand that they're of their time. They were both made in the late 60s. And the only thing they
No,
share, and it'll tell you how
Kelly's Heroes
great,
was 70 and
70, 68, 67,
no.
something like that. 60,
For the Dirty Dozen. The Dirty Dozen was
30
67.
dozen? 67. There you go. Kelly's Heroes was 70.
Yeah.
So late 60s, yeah, 1970, right in there. The only thing they have in common, as far as I can
Telly
remember, is
Savalas.
Telly Savalas. And Telly Savalas, tell you how good an actor he is, playing two polar opposite characters. You can't have two people who are more different.
Yes.
But you have to watch. The Dirty Dozen has some cameos in it that are just, you'll go, "Oh my God, that's him." It's like just somebody will
Yes.
walk through. Kelly's Heroes, I mean, but 30 Dozen has people in it who in the 60s were supposed to be important. Like no one knows who Trini Lopez is now.
Nope. Well, come on.
No one knows who
He broke his neck when he was parachuting in, so, he
no
only
one
was in
knows
half of
who no
the
one knows who Clint Walker is. No, but I mean it's
No, of
they
course,
don't
of
know
course.
why he was in the movie. Trini Lopez was a music star. He was what's his name? Feliz Navidad. He was who did Feliz Navidad? Who sang the theme to Chico and the Man?
I'm
Jose
thinking,
Feliciano. He was Jose Feliciano before Jose Feliciano was Jose Feliciano. So, Trini Lopez was the man. He was in this movie. It's like, geez, okay, great. There were some guys in there who you've never heard of, who you never will hear of. And there were guys who just disappeared after that movie. But I want to name another one I was in, but it wasn't very good.
What was the other one?
You
Just what was that one
Oh,
that
no,
you?
it was Behind Enemy Lines. Enemy Lines, I think it was called. Because as I said, we were talking about John Hannah the other week, and I was sitting on this plane waiting to fly to, I think it was Minsk, to shoot this movie, and all of a sudden I hear Cory Johnson as I live and breathe, and I was like, oh my God. It's like 15 years after The Mummy, 20 years after The Mummy, I'm working with John Hannah again. It was just heaven. It was just great. Just great. The ones I like, because I believe in a way this is another way that World War II was won, is by people who did something very small far away from the front lines, which is why one of them would have to be The Imitation Game.
Oh, great one.
Yeah. And another one, because I read the book before I saw the movie and I was disappointed by the movie. until I saw it again years later and went, oh my God, Eye of the Needle.
Ooh, I never
Oh
seen that
wow.
one.
It's a Ken
Donald
Follett
Sutherland.
book with Donald Sutherland and Kate Nelligan, who is just a brilliant, brilliant actress. She's a stage actor. And she was one of those people who she like Diane Venora. She was a theater actor, but she had something on film. And it was like when you're that good, they go, yeah, but you're not Meryl Streep. Part of the reason, look, I think Jessica Lange is a brilliant actress. Part of the reason I think she did as much work as she did was they went, she's like a young Meryl Streep. And it just greased her wheels a little bit, you know? She's like a sexy Meryl Streep, but Jessica Lange was Jessica Lange, you know? I mean, she was massive. But Kate Nelligan was just beautiful and intelligent, palpably intelligent. And there's something that's really captivating about that when you see that kind of intellect, in an actor. And so, yeah, I told you my choices were going to be like really weird. I mean,
I love them.
I should
Now
chuck
you
Private.
have to rank them.
I should chuck Private, right? Well, all right. Eye of the Needle will be last. It'll be fifth. Kelly's Heroes, just because it's fun. Just because it's fun as much as serious, will be fourth. I'm gonna put Dirty Dozen third. Private Ryan's got to be first, so Imitation Game is second.
All right, there you
Again,
go. That is
there's a
true.
scene in Imitation Game, where when he discovers that every message is going to have the word Heil Hitler in it, and you go, so we know what letters they are, and now we're giving them this enormous head start, and they're going to have weather, so we know Heil Hitler, we'll know what E is, and then we can find two E's in weather, and when we find that, we're going to know what W is and T, and the build of it was just, I mean, you were just shaking like, oh man, it was brilliant, just brilliant.
That is great. Okay, thank you very much for that list, Corey. So now we will move on to the Thursday segment, which is called Say What Thursday. Say what? Say
Say
what
what?
again? I dare you. I double dare you.
Go ahead. I double dare you.
Okay, so the idea behind this game is a very simple one. There are lots and lots of actors in this movie, and familiar actors. Some of them were less
Yep,
familiar at the
yep.
time. Some of them became blockbusters like Corey Johnson, and
Yep.
a lot of them. So
Some just became blocks.
also like Corey Johnson.
Also like Corey
There you go.
Johnson.
So I'm gonna give you a movie quote, and I will tell you
Okay.
the year that it came out, and you have to tell me who the actor is and what the movie is. Okay.
Okay.
But because there are so many different people to choose from, so you have three people. I've narrowed it down to only three people. It could either be something that's Tom
Okay.
Hanks, a quote from Tom Hanks, a quote from Ed
Oh.
Burns, or a quote from
Oh.
Corey Johnson.
Okay.
All right.
Well, that eliminates me because I didn't have any words.
Well, not no, not just
You don't know what the
no,
movies
it's
are.
not just quotes
Oh,
from Saving Private Ryan. It's quotes from other movies.
okay.
One from 2022. Okay. The quote is,
Yep.
"Now I don't know nothing about music, but I can see in that girl's eyes he was a taste of forbidden fruit. He could have eaten him alive."
The double negative is making me think it's not Tom Hanks, so I'm assuming it's Ed Burns.
No, it is not.
It's Tom
It is
Hanks.
Tom Hanks. So now, can you
Wow.
guess what movie it is from 2022 that he was in?
Say the line one more time.
Sure. "Now I don't know nothing about music, but I can see in that girl's eyes he was a taste of forbidden fruit. She could have eaten him alive."
2022.
I don't know.
This is one of the few times that, in my opinion, Tom Hanks is almost completely unrecognizable in a movie that he's in.
Oh God, of course, it's
Yes,
Elvis.
it is. There you go.
Ah. Yeah.
All right, the next one.
Yeah.
A movie from 1999. "I'm going downstairs. Get me a drink. You want something?"
Yeah, bourbon. Give me bourbon and a bourbon chaser. Oh God.
So who's the actor?
I don't know his name, but he's not very good. Did you know that Steve Dunham died a few years ago? Steve Dunham was the guy who was I was talking to
Okay. Well, we don't know who
in that
said
scene.
this. Who
I
said
said
this?
it. I said it.
You said it. And what was the movie?
The Mu Mai.
Mew Mai.
Kevin J. O'Connor. Kevin J. O'Connor played Benny. And we were at a dinner for Universal. Universal threw us a dinner in one of the sound stages. We played 20 minutes of the stuff we'd shot in Morocco. And I don't know if it was at the beginning or at the end, they put up this, you know, Steve Summers had created this amazing logo that would kind of start. It didn't start way distant and come forward. It started in behind you and came onto the screen, and so it got smaller as it went back. And it was MUMMY, and the middle M was like this. And so as it came in, you saw this huge V, and it moved back. It turned into an M, and then you saw the rest of the word coming back. And Kevin J. O'Connor immediately said, "What? Where's our movie? No, is you changing the name to MUVIMY? The name of the movie is the MUVIMY." And we were killing ourselves because you see this V, and then it says mu on one side and my on the other, and that was who he was. Kevin J. O'Connor would look at something and go, "It says MUVIMY. What's it? That's not mummy. Where's the mummy? We want to see the mummy. This is MUVIMY." He did that for about 10 minutes, and Steve Summers was just losing his mind. That was very funny.
Very
Yeah,
good.
that's from the MUVIMY.
Excellent. Okay, the next one is a movie from 2024. Can you get us a
Okay.
cup of coffee?
Can you get us a cup of coffee?
It could be Tom Hanks, Ed Burns, or Corey Johnson.
Can you get us a cup of coffee?
That's not enough.
It could be from September 5th.
And it is.
Yeah, so it must be me because Ed Burns and Tom Hanks were not in that movie.
No, they were not.
Yeah.
No, they were not.
There you go.
All right. The next
That was a
one.
good guess.
Well, I figured it was a recent one that maybe you'd remember the line that you had.
Yeah. No, it's amazing how you don't. A, I haven't seen the movie, and you know when you shoot it over 6 or 8 weeks, and you've got a handful of things to say or a bunch of things to make up, you don't remember anything you've said. You know, you've got no context for it, so you
Okay.
just, you know,
Right. Well,
yeah.
not
But
that, so you
weirdly,
haven't seen it?
no, I haven't seen it
The
yet.
next line after that is great. You just sent away the one person who can translate That's not from you. No, I'm saying that's that's the
Yeah.
context.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. Was it at the tape machine?
Yes.
You just sent away the one person who can translate. That's right. I remember that. Yeah.
That's right.
I remember that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Because she was German and I told her to get out.
That is correct.
It was all part of the sexism, you see?
Why haven't you seen the movie?
Because, well, I don't see what I'm in. You know, it's hard. It's hard seeing what you've done. Yeah.
Okay, the next one is from 1995.
Ed Burns, the brothers McMullen. I was waiting for 95.
Okay, so what's the quote?
I don't know. Doesn't matter. You always did have a good left hook.
There you go. I like being a pessimist. It helps me deal with my inevitable failure.
Ed Burns.
Yeah.
What's the movie?
The brothers
Brothers
McMullen.
McMillan. Yeah.
Oh, right, really? He was right about both of
Yeah,
those
of course I
things?
was waiting for 1995. I was thinking, did Tom Hanks do anything in 95? I'm sure he did, but it's going to be Ed Burns.
Apollo 13, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Could be. And the final one for you is a movie from 2023. We've gone from JFK, Dr. King, and the Beatles to reality TV, Donald Trump, and the baby fart song.
Have you seen that?
No, I haven't yet. I want to.
Oh,
Yeah.
yeah. It's on
What is
Amazon,
it?
I think.
What is it?
Well, I'm not sure what it's called. Is it Warhol or Midnight Caller?
It's both. I on
Yeah.
IMDb it
Yeah.
calls it it under you when you go to your list of movies on IMDb it says Midnight
Yeah.
Caller, but when you click on the movie, and then it tells you it's
Yeah.
Warhol.
Wow. Wow. Yeah.
Okay, great.
It's on Amazon Prime, so you should watch it.
It's on my list that I want to get to, for sure.
You'll have to come back when he does watch it.
Yeah.
Right, here's a
Yeah.
bonus one for you without any context. I don't know if you're going to be able to guess this one. From 2007, they found a body.
They found a body. Is it Mystic River?
That was
Oh, it's
2004.
Tom. It's Tom Hanks or Ed Burns.
Actually, it's not.
Okay, good. 2007, they found a body. They found a body. They found a body. No.
Yeah, then the next line is born. He goes, nope, Dash.
Esh. That was mine.
Yes, it was yours.
In what?
Born in a Bourne Ultimatum.
Bone.
They found a body. Yeah, Desh. You see, there are so many bits in that movie that I'd love to do again because I just gave them too much. And it's just like you go, well, you don't know what's going on. You don't have all the pieces. So when you say someone's name, you go Desh. You know, it's just Desh. That's it. You don't say Desh. Bad. It's not bad. It's just Desh. You know,
Well, they
it's
gave
like
you another
Nicky
chance by
Parsons.
coming to another Bourne movie after that. So, you know, there
Yeah.
did you feel you did a better job in the second one, the next one that you did?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
What do you feel like was your best work?
The thing I did last.
Is that what would you ask answer that every time I ask you something?
Yeah, pretty much.
So now we will get to Friday's segment, which is Filmmaker Friday,
Filmmaker Friday.
where you both will tell me your top five Steven Spielberg directed films. So we'll do the same way that we did earlier this week. We'll do it snake fashion. Okay,
Okay.
so Christian, you go first.
Is it possible for me to do the same thing that I did with John and just name them and then rank them later?
Sure, why not?
Okay. All right. Bridge of Spies.
Number five. Oh no, that's just one of them.
One of them.
Okay. One of mine?
You're just gonna do
Close
one. Okay.
Encounters.
All
Okay.
right. Another one of yours, Corey.
Oh,
Snake.
just anyone or just like
Whatever you want to do.
specifically?
If you want to do it, if you want to do 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, you know, that's fine by me too.
No. Catch Me If You Can.
Oh, that was my next one.
Okay, that's good. That's great. I tell you why, and I didn't mention it with the John Williams segment, but the music is such a big part of that movie.
Oh, I
The
know.
music reminds me of the music in Jaws when they're
Yes.
chasing the shark for the first time, and they play some really, I hate saying lighthearted music, but it was pursuit music, and it didn't sound like things were going to get bad. It sounded like this is really hopeful, and you don't think about they're pursuing and attempting to capture and kill another animal, and we're playing this movie that's like really kind of hopeful. It's like they're skating on ice. It was just odd, but it was such a great choice. The music in Catch Me If You Can was like that. It was very, were you the one who described it as like very jazzy?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It was very, yeah, jazzy and kind of freeform, and you got the feeling that that's what this guy's thing was all about. It was very kind of, it was loose, loose and louche.
Yes. Well, okay. So Catch Me If You Can is mine.
Okay,
I'm
that's
adding that to
okay.
my list.
Okay. Then your next one, Christian?
The Post.
Good one. Good
All
one.
right. Corey?
Munich.
Okay. Again, Corey.
Jaws.
Okay. Christian?
E.T.
Yeah, I'm gonna stay away from all of those.
And your final
They're
one,
close encounters. Well,
Christian.
there are genre ones. Yeah, there are genre ones, and I just want to get one genre and then keep away from the other ones.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's tough for me because the last three are all kind of tied, and that would be, you know, Saving Private Ryan, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Jurassic Park. And,
Yeah.
you know, those are all the big ones. And so how do I rank those? I would say,
So you have 8 movies that you're ranking 1 through 5, right?
Yeah. I've
Okay,
got
just
three
checking.
that are tied. I've got three that
She's
are tied.
got four or five are tied for fifth place.
Yep.
Well,
Yep.
you did say at the beginning that you wanted to do a top 25, so I understand.
Yes, I did. So Bridge of Spies is number one. I'm gonna do it in this order. Bridge of Spies, Catch Me If You Can, The Post, E.T., and then Saving Private Ryan, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Jurassic Park are tied for fifth.
That's sort of cheating, but all right, that's fine. I'll let it go. I'll let it go.
Yeah. I would have Raiders no, I would have Jaw no. I would have Close Encounters as fifth. And weirdly, it's like that's kind of no slouch because I keep looking for things he did when he did things that were had he had done something in these movies that weren't like anything he'd done or anything anyone had done before. So I think Close Encounters is going to be fifth. I'm trying to think if I'm going to say Catch Me If You Can will be fourth. And Munich is third. Jaws is second. And Raiders is first.
Okay, so it's the same order that you said. That's perfect.
Because Raiders is the purest example of movie making I can think of.
And mine is in the order for me of storytelling and sort of what catches my heart or interest, except for the last three. Like, the reason they're there is they probably all should be number one, but they're just so common and everybody would put them at number one. And so I didn't want to put them there.
But it's easy. It's easy to say. I mean, neither one of us, you could make a top five of the movies we didn't pick. Neither one of us even put Schindler's List
I
on.
know. I
And
know.
that's the one he
I
won the
know.
Oscar for.
I know. I that's I mean, that's why I couldn't put it there. We didn't we I know.
Well, Private Ryan, it's why I said, I don't want to put Private Ryan because it was too easy,
It's too easy. Yeah.
But
The Fablemans we didn't put on there. We didn't put Lincoln on
we didn't
there.
put AI, we didn't put Lincoln, we
World
didn't put The
War of the
Color
Worlds.
Purple,
We didn't put
that's why.
Empire of the Sun.
But you see those, there were movies like, when you think he made some, I hate saying fun movies, but some funny movies. And you go, 1941 was one of the great sort of, I'm just going to throw everything at it movie. There are very few people who could have directed that. And he did. And it didn't work. But it didn't do anything to end his career,
No, not at all.
I mean, he just sort of kept going. I mean, I'm looking at a list now. The Sugarland Express. Good God. They've got Bullet on this list. That's just not a thing Steven Spielberg directed.
No, is it, that's what is, he's making a remake, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's making it with Bradley Cooper, but they don't even have the year on it. Anyway. Yeah, I was going to say Amblin, which was his first, but
Yes. Have you
yeah,
seen
I
it?
don't know why.
Have you seen?
No.
Oh, okay. I've seen it. It's an interesting
Your
movie. Oh,
movie
you mean
watching
Amblin?
ability.
I mean,
Amblin. No,
Amblin.
I've seen Amblin. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Your movie watching ability, Rob, is astounding.
Thank you. I hope you guys are too, and that you're not suffering too much.
No.
Suffering too much.
I always have fun with Corey.
Say what? That's a great game.
All right, so why don't you both tell everyone how they can get in touch with you if they want to.
If they want to. You can
When they
drop me a
want
line at Corey at
to, Corey.
documentaryfirst.com. That'll be
Yeah, there
great.
you go. If you'll check your email.
Yeah, I do every once in a while.
All right, say that
Yeah.
again.
Go ahead, block up my mailbox at Corey at documentaryfirst.com and
And
watch for my podcast about golf.
yeah, so how can they find your podcast? What's it called?
As soon as I figure it out, I'll let you know.
All in one.
You can find me at documentaryfirst.com. That you'll find movies I've done. You'll find me at the Documentary First podcast, wherever you get your podcast, or Documentary First on all social media platforms. You can write me at Christian@documentaryfirst.com. And you can also find me at thegirlwhowarefreedom.com. You can watch The Girl Who Wore Freedom on Apple TV, Amazon, YouTube, Vudu, just about any place like that. And we would appreciate you watching. You'll help us finish paying off the movie. It's a great movie. You won't regret it.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So I want to once again thank you both for joining me this week. It's been so eye-opening. I've learned so much, not just about Saving Private Ryan, but everything else
No,
about
it's just
making movies.
fun talking about the work sometimes.
That's right.
It
For
is.
sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Much
Nice to meet
appreciated.
you.
You got you're welcome. I'm glad that we met. And
Me too.
you guys will definitely be welcome back any other time in the future if you're interested.
And I just want to say thank you to your listeners. If you've made it this far, wow, you are incredible. You deserve a
Yeah.
star. So.
Yeah, if you can listen. If you can listen to me for 45 minutes without your ears bleeding, you've done good. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. No, but
Yeah.
Christian, are you talking about them listening to the three of us talking this week, or the fact that they've now listened to over 1,050 episodes of me.
Both.
Got it.
Both.
All right. Well, I will be back on Monday with a new guest. So everyone have a great weekend. And until then, earn this.
Earn this.
Earn this.